I'm Ben Wallace.
Hi, I'm Michael Wong.
And we are Truly Free. This is the Counter Apologetics podcast that we do from time to time. And today we're actually doing part two of a topic that we raised in our last episode. Mm-hmm. Michael, do you want to give the audience an introduction to what we're talking about this afternoon?
Sure. We're going to talk about hell and justice. And, you know, the question of, you know, how is it that a good God would torture anyone forever? And, you know, is that, you know, I mean, in the last episode, we talked a bit about, you know, the notion that morality is somehow rooted in theism, that we need God to be the basis of morality. And I don't know, I don't think there's anything to that. We talked about that in the previous podcast. But, you know, it's rather striking that theists who believe, you know, not all theists believe in hell, of course, but for those Christians and, you know, Muslims and other theists who believe in hell, that they would go and you know, purport to represent this wonderful moral view, and at the same time endorse allowing others to suffer forever, to say that the most good and beautiful and perfect being would allow others to be tormented, would arrange the universe so that others would end up being tormented. And so that's what we're going to talk about today.
You wanted to look at William Lane Craig's response to this. Now, I was looking over William Lane Craig's debate with,
with Dr. Bradley. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this debate with Bradley. William Lane Craig took the position, he said right up front, look, you need to give a logical contradiction here. If you can't give a logical contradiction between God being loving and God sending people to hell, then it's logically possible that God could send people to hell and still be loving, and that's fine then. Yeah, that's all we need, is that possibility. Mm-hmm. That sounds kind of weak. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I suppose it depends upon what you want to argue about. I believe that Bradley's position was that it was logically impossible. So, you know, if he's going to go and make such a strong claim, well, yeah, it doesn't take much to rebut it. But I guess if Craig wanted to respond to someone who, you know, wasn't concerned to make such a strong statement about the incompatibility of a good God in hell, well, then, you know, it would be harder for him to respond, right? If we wanted to say instead that not that it's logically impossible, but it's very implausible that a good God would allow anyone to suffer forever in hell, well, you know, that would change the nature of the discussion, right?
I think so. I think what Craig wants to say is that it's not possible for God to create the best world that he can and still have everyone go to heaven. That seems to be his take on the matter. And, gosh, I don't see how he accomplishes that.
Yeah, it's a shame that in the debate we're talking about, which you can find online pretty easily, Bradley kind of drops the ball, though, at the end. I know you haven't listened to the debate, but you've read some of the kind of a summary of
it. Right, I've read the transcript.
Yeah, and the and, you know, in the end, Craig argues that heaven isn't or may not be a possible world. It may not be possible for God to just create people who are going to go to heaven, or just to create people who are already in heaven. That may not be a possible world at all. Why? Well, because for him to go and create people who are going to be in heaven, they have to, you know, in some sense, they have to have chosen to be there. They have, you know, their free will, they have to, by an act of free will, they have to have chosen, I suppose, ultimately to have trusted in Jesus, since, you know, everybody chooses to sin on the Christian view. And it's only through the redemption of the sacrifice of God to himself through Jesus that, you know, people can get off the hook. But people have to, you know, on an evangelical view, people have to freely choose to partake in the sacrifice of Jesus.
Right. If you're not a Calvinist, then likely as not, free will is going to be a big deal to you as a Christian. And this is the vision that Craig has. He talks about this a lot in his debate. To him, free choice is something that almost at any cost must be respected. And even if we grant that there's some that there is something like free will, which I don't think that there is an incompatibility between free will and making the world a certain way and making people a certain way. I don't take an incompatibilist position. But if you are going to be an incompatibilist, and if you say that there's free will, I don't think that you get to automatically assume that free will is something that needs to be respected at all costs. It seems to me that if the only way to go and respect free will is to have people tortured for the rest of forever, I think that's a pretty big deterrent from allowing free will in those cases, at least.
Absolutely, I agree. I think that what Craig would wants to say, even though he didn't quite say this explicitly in the debate, but what I took from it was that he would want to say that, look, if you don't have the chance to live a life in this world as we do, with the kinds of temptations and you know, experiences with bad people, you know, as well as good people, if you don't have the kind of some kind of experience analogous to the experience that we have on Earth, you're in no position to make that free choice. It strikes me that if that's the case, and if God foreknows, as Craig believes God does foreknow, you know, who's going to ultimately be saved and who isn't, who's going to make that choice, and you know, who is going to make that choice and who isn't going to make that choice. If God foreknows that, you know, it, you know, as you say, not only, you know, doesn't it seem to be justified for the sake of some people going into heaven to allow, I would say, anyone to go and be tortured forever or to suffer forever, but that it would be completely unnecessary, even if you take that view, to actually create any souls that would choose, or through their choices, merit damnation. I mean, why couldn't God simply create? I mean, if I'm destined for heaven and I need to have the experiences I'm going to have in this world, well, why couldn't God go and create, you know, instead of actually creating the souls of the people who are going to be damned to hell, why couldn't he just kind of create philosophical zombies, people who act and talk as if they have a soul, but really they're just machines? And that way I could have all the same experiences that I'm having right now, only, you know, without actually having to interact with people who are ultimately going to be damned. Do you see where I'm going?
Sure, I absolutely do. I guess here's a possible objection, though. If you're going to make a philosophical zombie, I think we might be willing to agree that it's possible if you know exactly what it's going to do. But if you need it to be responsive to free choices, for example, suppose you have, okay, here's someone with a soul, and he's going to go and make free choices throughout his life. Now, if you set up the philosophical zombie to respond to the free choices, that seems to require peeking in on all those free choices. And I'm not sure, I don't know, maybe some Christians would be willing to accept that. I'm not sure all of them would.
Well, let's remember that Craig isn't an open theist. An open theist is someone, and this is a minority position in Christianity, but an open theist maintains that God actually doesn't foreknow everything that we're going to do. That we can surprise God, that he doesn't know the future. He can do a lot to make the future go the way he wants the future to go. But there are sometimes we make choices and God just doesn't know what's going to happen until we make the choice. That's not William Lane Craig's position, and that's not the position of most theists, in my experience anyway. That's not a mainstream view in any case. For most theists who accept what we would call this libertarian conception of free will, like William Lane Craig does, they would say that that God knows ahead of time every single choice that I'm going to make, yet I'm going to make those choices freely. We aren't going to get into how that's supposed to work if there is even a coherent notion there. But let's just take that for granted, okay, God knows exactly what I'm going to do. Well, if he knows exactly what I'm going to do, even if I'm going to be free, then why can't he create the zombie? And I hope we weren't too quick in evoking the philosophical zombie. I hope sometimes, you know, Ben and I may take things for granted.
So a philosophical zombie, of course, is just a body that walks around and talks, and it does all the things that an ordinary person would do, but it's not really a person. It doesn't have experiences. It doesn't think and feel. It really is a robot in the sense that most libertarian free willers want to talk about being robots.
Well, it's more than a robot, because even somebody who advocates, or I should say less than a robot, because even people who advocate for libertarian free will, they still might concede that you could still be conscious and yet not have free will. But a philosophical zombie isn't even conscious. They can sit and talk about their feelings. They can go and say, well, you know, yeah, I'm feeling really bad today. It's been a horrible day. They could do anything that you've ever seen anyone do, but in reality, they aren't having a bad day. They aren't having a good day. They're just a machine. Yeah, indeed, they're just as most of us tend to think about a machine. You know, my thermostat presumably just doesn't have good or bad days. It just does what it does, and that's all a philosophical zombie does. So, you know,
right.
So, you know, again, I just to reiterate the point that I made earlier, you know, why on earth, if God does foreknow what we're all going to do, those of us who are destined for heaven because we're going to make the right free choices, why can't he just not create the souls that he might have created that would make those bad choices, and instead just make philosophical zombies, mindless things that will act in an appropriate way, so those of us with souls will have the right experiences, and then we'll make our choices and we'll go to heaven.
Seems awfully strange. It's like a science fiction type counterexample, but if you're going to hold to omniscience in the way that William Lane Craig apparently does, where you don't think that people can genuinely surprise God. God knows in advance what's going to happen. It's just somehow out of his control with regard to our free choices. Again, I'm not sure how that's supposed to work, but it's not for ignorance of reading about it. It's just I don't think they have a coherent view. But anyway, I digress. If you have that view of omniscience, then, yeah, I don't see how we're going to deny the possibility, the conceivability of really having a universe where there's only souls who are going to freely choose God, and the rest, well, those are souls which, well, they're not souls, they're philosophical zombies. But it is kind of strange, and I can think of two possible lines of objection. Here's one. Because it's so strange, well, the Christian might argue that we're not really in a good position to say whether or not that's really possible. I mean, it's really foreign to our experience. Talking about philosophical zombies walking around, that's a little unusual. So maybe we just don't know enough to say that it's logically possible.
Well, I think my first response would be, you know, God should be able. I mean,
it's a tough objection.
I would say that we have dreams all the time, and in our dreams, we talk with people. We have experiences with people as if they were real. But in fact, presumably, you know, the people that are in my dreams aren't real people at all. It's just my impressions, my experiences, and I infer that there's a person there on the basis of, or take for granted that there's a person there, you know, because of the nature of my experiences. If that's possible, why wouldn't a philosophical zombie be possible? I'll tell you what, we can show, I think, that a philosophical zombie is possible in a little way. If we just, you know, suppose that God knows me really, really well, and he knows everything I'm going to do. Well, he could, you know, the only thing that would have to go into making a philosophical zombie is for him to go and kind of pre-record, you know, in some sense, everything that that body is going to do, everything it's going to say. It's not as if the problem is that like the materialist might have, which is to go and, you know, it's funny because often it's the immaterialist, the person who believes this is a consciousness, is distinct from the structure of a brain as it acts in motion. You know, it's often the immaterialist who says, well, really, zombies are logically possible. Therefore, consciousness is distinct from just a body in motion, just a, you know, an operating brain. But in this case, I guess you'd have the immaterialist arguing that it's impossible to have in somebody who behaves just as we behave, who has the neurology that we have, and yet you know, still there's no soul involved, there's no consciousness there. But I think it's, since we really don't need an organism that is truly reactive to its environment, since all we really need is just a pre-recorded performance, just like if you've ever been to an amusement park and you have animatronic Abraham Lincoln and George Washington, and they get up and they go and they say their thing and they talk to each other, you know, they aren't. Those are like philosophical zombies. Only God would be a much better animatronics engineer than the people at Disney World who make the walking, talking presidents. You know, why on earth wouldn't that be logically possible? Just for God to just pre-program all their responses? I don't know.
Well, I don't think that we would have a good reason to take it as logically impossible. But again, William Lane Craig seems to want to emphasize that there's a sort of burden of proof on the objector here, the hell objector, if you will. And that burden of proof is, we really have to show or give a reason to think that it would be logically possible. And I don't know, I'm hard-pressed to do that, I guess, except to say that we tend to take things as logically possible in a sense by default. And if we don't have any outstanding reason to think that it's logically impossible, well, seems like we ought to consider it as probably logically possible. Now, that's a little weak, I know. Maybe there's a better response. I do know this, however. William Lane Craig also wants, and I think most Christians really want, not to just throw up their hands and say, well, I don't know how it's possible, but, or I don't know, you know, all the ins and outs of it, but, well, I know that God is good, I know he sends people to hell, so there must be some reason that he sends them to hell, some logical impossibility preventing him from creating another kind of universe where people don't go to hell. They can throw up their hands and give that kind of, well, I don't know, but it must be something like that kind of approach. But I don't think that that's going to satisfy them. That's not what they seem to want to do. That's not what Craig wants to do.
Well,
yeah, so...
in terms of it being logically impossible, is there something wrong with my dream example? I mean, don't we have clear cases where we believe that we're interacting with another person with their own point of view, and in fact we don't in our dreams? Or, here's another example, when we are online and we think we're talking to a person, but we're really talking to a bot, you know, if you're in a chat room, you can have these programs that will go and talk to you and respond and ask questions and answer questions. And for a little while, you might be, if you ask the right questions and you aren't being careful, you might think that you're actually talking to a real person in a chat room. So it seems like we have examples of us being fooled by things that seem like conscious beings when in fact they aren't really conscious beings. So doesn't that disprove the notion that it's logically impossible that there be zombies?
I don't see that it does, actually. I mean, you could say that we have dream experiences and they resemble what you're imagining here. But the resemblance is going to be imperfect, and any time you have an imperfection like that, well, there's an opportunity for some anomaly to pop up and cause a logical problem.
But I'm perfectly fooled for a while, right? While I'm dreaming, I'm perfectly fooled.
I don't think it's enough to just fool you, though. I mean, it has to do more than fool you. It has to actually recreate the situation that we would have if there was a person with a soul doing what the philosophical zombie's doing. You know what I mean? It's not like God can just create a bunch of people he knows will freely choose and then throw them into a situation and let them freely choose. That's not going to be quite how it works. He knows that they're going to freely choose under particular circumstances, right? Well, he's bound, or at least he... I thought that you wanted to have him bound to the exact circumstances that lead to those people freely choosing what they freely choose. If it's not the exact same situation, if the philosophical zombies aren't doing what the actual ensouled damned people would do, then how do you know that? How are we supposed to guarantee that the ensouled people are going to freely choose heaven under those different circumstances? Okay. It's kind of a mouthful. I hope I got my point across.
Okay, well, here's what I would say then. Try this, all right? The only way that I know that other people exist is through my five senses, right? Maybe arguably other senses. We do have other senses. But through my, you know, whatever, eight senses, however many, you know, ways I can be aware of other things in my environment. If you look at any of those senses, they're, you know, it's just a matter of nerve cells being, firing, right? I mean, neurons firing. God would certainly be capable of understanding. He would know, presumably, the entire pattern of sensory neuron firings that will take place throughout my life. I mean, he would know that before I ever even had them. All he has to do to effectively have a philosophical zombie is to have that very same pattern of neural firings occur. He doesn't even have to have something external to me causing those neural firings. He just has to have those neural firings, actually happen. So it seems to me that it's pretty clear that any experience that I have interacting with others can be that it can't be logically impossible for me to replicate them, since after all, they are just causal factors, just one causal factor in making those neurons fire. And God would have the ability to make those neurons fire all by himself. Isn't that a refutation?
Maybe. I guess, okay, so you want to say that there's no real causal connection between the immaterial mind that the dualist believes in and the material body that the materialists believe in.
I don't think I'm committed to that, because after all, I'm not even suggesting that that God needs to go and just directly manipulate the immaterial mind, though I don't have a problem with that. We could be fully embodied, but God could still go and manipulate our neurons directly to create the experience of interacting with other people who aren't actually there.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not that I see anything wrong with it. It's just that, I don't know, there seem to be lots of probably mundane assumptions, but assumptions nonetheless. And any one of those assumptions, well, there's a place that the apologist can come in and be a skeptic. Should we actually assume this? Well, I don't know. I'm sure some Christian out there, I'm sure that William Lane Craig, excuse me, not some Christian out there, I'm sure that any Christian out there would want to go and look for some kind of assumption that you're making there and be a skeptic towards it.
Well, again, all I can do is put the argument out there. It seems to me that it's solid. We should always be fallibilists and be open to the possibility that there's something that we're missing. But I think that that's pretty solid. I guess there is one objection that I can imagine someone would make. They could say, well, that would mean that God would have to kind of be responsible for whatever that zombie did. Any of its behavior would be God's behavior, because he arranged things so that it would behave the way it behaved, as opposed to having what I would say the scapegoat of this other being that freely chooses, who might, so God could say, well, I didn't do this bad thing. This guy, other guy with free will did this bad thing. You see what I'm saying?
Sure. Yeah, that actually sounds like a good objection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have...
I assume you have a response.
I do. I do have, I think, maybe a couple of responses. I would say, first of all, I would make the case that God's hands are already dirty insofar as he has played a necessary role, if not a sufficient role, in any evil that somebody does, in that he went and he put, he knew that a given evildoer would do the evil that they would do when he created them and put them in that position. And so the responsibility isn't shifted. It's not even really divided. It's simply multiplied, because you needed both the decision of this, ensouled evildoer and you needed the decision of God to go and put him there. Why is it that it's better for God to put a real evildoer there, thereby facilitating this evil act, versus, because he knows what this evildoer is going to do, once again, versus going and placing a zombie who will do the exact same thing? God's hands are just as dirty when it comes to the particular evil act being done, but at least in the case of the philosophical zombie, they aren't further dirtied by somebody going to hell. And at least in the case of the philosophical zombie, obviously any evil that would be done would serve a greater good of having all of these beings that will end up in heaven. I mean, to go and say that that wouldn't be worthwhile for God to do is to say that it really isn't worthwhile for God to create the world to begin with to get these people to heaven. And obviously it is worthwhile. We're assuming it's worthwhile, for the sake of argument here. So I don't know. I think that that's a good response.
Well, okay. Maybe. See, here's the thing, though. If you're going to be a believer in libertarian free will, and again, I can't stress how much I think that libertarianism is just nonsense, but But if we're going to go ahead and try to avoid having to be sucked into a conversation about free will, and we grant it for the sake of argument, well, I think free will is seen as kind of a buffer between creating a person and being responsible for that person's actions. So if God creates a person who does something morally wrong, well, even if God knew that that person would do that morally wrong thing, supposedly free will is supposed to get him off the hook there. On the other hand, I do think that, you have a great point, though, about not having people sent to hell. Seems like God has a choice between a world where people are sent to hell, and this is just, according to William Lane Craig, or where he has to go and to create these philosophical zombies to do bad things. I don't know. That seems a strange moral question. And of course, I would want to come down on the same side as you. I would want to say, well, of course, you know, don't create the people who are destined for eternal torture. That seems to be a high priority.
Yeah, it's pretty clear.
But I don't know. I think that Christians like to get caught up in these ideals of perfect justice and this perfect system of rules that are enforced. Well, and yeah, so I'm not so sure that they'd. In fact, I'm fairly sure that they wouldn't want to hop on board with us on that count.
Well, we have biblical support for the idea that God, you know, manipulates people so that they will do evil. After all, God hardened Pharaoh's heart. Presumably, Pharaoh actually had free will, and in some sense, you know, God, you know, I don't know, hijacked Pharaoh for a while, or at least, you know, again, as you've alluded to, the notion of libertarian free will, I don't think there's even an idea there. It's not even coherent enough to be wrong, in my view. But even so, kind of going along with the way people talk about libertarian free will, presumably God influenced Pharaoh in any case to go and do what he wanted him to do. He made it the case that Pharaoh would do what he wanted him to do. So again, there, God is having a hand in evil. There are...
Are you sure that... obviously, a Calvinist would want to say that, right? But are you sure a non-Calvinist would go ahead and interpret that passage the way you just have?
Well, how would a non-Calvinist interpret that? I have never heard a good apologetic for that. It seems that non-Calvinists will want to say that something like this. They might want to say that... Pharaoh was, already, I mean, that Pharaoh still had his choice, but in some way God just really leaned on him, you know. I don't know, maybe there's a better, apologetic than that. Are you familiar with any?
Unfortunately, I'm not. I try to stay away from theological squabbling between Christians, but, I guess I would just expect them to... I wouldn't even expect them to say what you said about God leaning on them. No, I think that they would want to really preserve Pharaoh's free will and just explain away this verse or this passage by making it out to be a turn of phrase that means something different.
I guess I've heard that too, which seems like, an evasion to me. It's pretty clear.
Oh, sure, but... that's how it goes, though.
Yeah, no doubt that's how it goes. But I guess they could say this as well. They could say, well, Pharaoh wasn't free there, but that doesn't mean he wasn't generally free. After all, many Christians will say, who believe in libertarian free will say, we aren't saying that everything that someone does is free, that every choice is freely made, just that some are. You know, it doesn't have to be the case that we're always free. We just need to have at least one free choice along the way, probably more than that, but we just need one. So they might say Pharaoh wasn't free then at that particular moment. Of course, if they say that, then that means that God did indeed, just make it the case that Pharaoh did evil, right? So that wouldn't work for this particular problem that that we're talking about.
So you want to say that there's scriptural support. And I guess I think you're right, but it's going to be like pulling teeth to get Christians who don't already have that interpretation to agree with you.
Sure. It very well may be like pulling teeth. But anyway, I think for the reasons I expressed earlier, though, I think that the God can't do evil response is weak. You know, for the reasons I've already expressed, no reason to restate them. So I guess that's the stand that I'm going to take on that. Again, let me say this too, though, that I kind of emphasize something I mentioned. If you're going to say that it's a good act to go and create a world like this, I mean, look, what if it were the case that no possible person would do what God needed them to do? You know, what if there were no, you know, evildoers there to facilitate, you know, kind of possible evildoers that would facilitate the kind of environment that God wanted, you know, which is, it's weird to even talk this way. It's all just bound up in Craig's, Molinism and stuff, but which we aren't, I don't think we should get into right now. But supposing that it weren't the case that that there were any such beings available in some sense, would it then have been, I guess, if you know, you'd have to go and say that, if that's the case, then it would have been better for God not to create a world at all, because if he created a world full of people who are going to go to heaven, he would have to go and get his hands dirty and do the evil directly without having the rather, really lame excuse of having this being that he created who could do his dirty work for him. I just want to point out that there's a real sense in which it's a great thing that there are evildoers out there. You know, they help to make for the best of all possible worlds, the fact that there are these potential evildoers. Our Christians are going to be comfortable with saying that evil, really, how did you get to heaven? Well, certainly God helped a lot. But man, if it weren't for those people willfully doing evil, you wouldn't have made it, man. They're your savior too, you know. As much as God might be your savior, you needed them. I think Christians ought to chew on that for a bit. But there's so much wrong with this. There's so much else wrong with this. Maybe we should move beyond the philosophical zombie.
Yeah, no, that's okay. I'd mentioned another objection that I had, but that's okay. We don't need to get to that one. The other thing that he says. He's got this story of, and it really is the typical evangelical Christian story, I think, at least according to my experience. And the story is, well, God loves justice. God is perfectly just. It's part of his nature. He can't help but be just. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he's super loving. He really loves his creation. He loves all his children here on earth. And so he wants to go and send his son to die on the cross to satisfy the justice. But God also really loves free will, and you have to freely choose to accept the substitutionary atonement of Jesus in order to get to heaven. Because if you don't get to heaven, the only alternative is separation from God, and that is just equivalent to eternal torment. That's what hell is. It's this sort of... And here I don't know if William Lane Craig actually takes this part of the view, this bit about separation, but it's something that I hear commonly, so I'm going to go ahead and add it in. But the separation from God, of course, is something that we choose freely, and it consists of horrible, horrible torture and torment. This is the story that he envisions, and I don't know about you, but I think it's ridiculous. I already mentioned why I don't think that free will is something to be treasured more than, not allowing people to suffer hideous torment, but also justice. I'm not a big fan of divine justice. I don't see what purpose it serves, and I don't have an appreciation of it for its own sake. Even if you had an appreciation of it for its own sake, though, even if you really loved the rules of justice, is it morally acceptable to love them so much that you're willing to have other people tormented for eternity just so that you can sit back and say, wow, these rules are really great when they're in action? Yeah. That seems to me to be absurd.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. We're talking about retributive justice. The word justice is used in different ways. We're talking about the idea that it's a great thing that somebody who does something wrong suffers for it. And for its own sake. I mean, it's not as if there's some kind of retribution serves some kind of instrumental purpose. You know, we can go and, you know, like punishment for other reasons might. I mean, there are different reasons why we punish, right? For instance, we want to deter the wrongdoer from committing future offenses. We want to deter others from doing what the wrongdoer did. Those are reasons to punish that serve the purpose for us human beings with our limited resources of protecting us from each other. If we go and kill or imprison a wrongdoer, we also go and protect ourselves from anything else that wrongdoer might do, whether or not they're deterred or not, right? It's kind of a side effect from, the fact it happens to be a punishment, but just to go and kill the person makes us safe, whether it's a punishment or not. But retribution, that it's different. It's not about, protecting ourselves, at least not in any direct way. There's a sense in which somebody being motivated, being the kind of person who would likely go and retaliate, even at a great cost to himself. If you're going to go and say, "Gee, that person wronged me. I don't care what I'm going to lose. I'm going to go after that person and I'm going to go and kill him to go and get revenge." It's possible for somebody to have that attitude, even though both they and society and everything else would be worse off because they're willing to go and pursue that revenge. That can being that kind of person under the right circumstances can still be an advantageous thing, both for the person who feels that way and for society in general, if potential wrongdoers are aware that, gee, if I go and I do this, this guy's going to get me come hell or high water. No practical concerns are going to dissuade him, so I better not go and tick this guy off to begin with. So in that sense, we could even go and say that there's some point for human beings to want to go and punish people for their own sake. Just for the sake of going and getting them, at least under some circumstances. I think that's pretty ugly, and that at least in most, in contemporary society, we're better off without that particular motivation. But because there's a downside to it too. But what unifies all of these conceptions of punishment, what justifies any kind of punishment, is the long-term effect of such a punishment or such an attitude on the well-being of conscious beings who can suffer and enjoy their life. And that's what matters in the end. If you're a god, if you have the kind of absolute power that God has, it just doesn't make any sense to punish people at all. I mean, you can go and protect people from other people. You can protect people from wrongdoers. I like to use the example of fish. If I have two fish in a tank and they're fighting each other, or one of them keeps on attacking the other, I don't have to go and punish the one fish. I can just take them out and put them in another tank, and then the two fish won't fight. You know, and if I'm very mature and sophisticated, if I'm a reflective person, I'm not going to have any desire for vengeance against this fish, who, after all, is a
nice little example. I love your fish example, so please continue.
I mean, after all, the point is the suffering is a bad thing. The suffering inflicted upon the other fish is a bad thing. That can be prevented. And to the extent to which people are good people, they don't want suffering. They don't want the fish to suffer. They just want all the fish to go and have good lives if you're compassionate toward your fish, as I think we ought to be. You know, presumably fish have a point of view and they can indeed suffer. And God's in the same position relative to us. There's no reason why he needs to go and punish people if he can just protect people from each other, and he can do that easily. So there's no point in retribution or any punishment at all, you know, given God's power and capacity. Now, again, buying into this notion of libertarian free will, you may say, well, you know, God wants to go and make people who have good character. So maybe you're going to go and have some suffering so that he can go and, build the kind of people that he wants to build. I've got problems with that I'm not going to get into here, but even if that's the case, even if you're going to allow people to actually hurt each other, you're going to allow a Hitler and so on. Well, after they're dead, after your little social experiment is over where people can inflict suffering on each other, you know, like I say, if you're going to let the fish gnaw on each other's tails and stuff, and because somehow that makes for some good fish that are going to go and come to you for safety or something. Well, when your experiment's done, there's no reason to torture the bad fish. There's no reason to torture Hitler. You know, you could annihilate him, or even better, you could give him just a great afterlife, you know, where he can't hurt anybody anymore, but where, you know, everything's good. It doesn't make any sense. Both, you know, I mean, in two ways it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense, you know, certainly, you know, just given like what a reflective human being would think about punishment. I mean, to the extent to which we can separate ourselves and kind of stand kind of above the fray of the world, we can look down on it and say, well, really, what we have here are just a bunch of organisms who are weak and scared and just struggling to survive and to go and satisfy their urges and desires. I mean, you know, it doesn't really take much reflective thought to have compassion for anyone in principle. And God really ought to be in an optimal position to be reflective in that way. So it doesn't make any sense that God would have this rage. It's frankly, even for human beings, it's infantile to be as angry and as, you know, is just concerned about getting people and making them pay as the God of the Bible is. When I see people I admire, the people who I respect as being really good people, they aren't vindictive like that. They're people who are, you know, predominantly compassionate, everyone feels anger sometimes, but their anger doesn't, you know, it's something almost external to them. It doesn't guide their actions, at least, you know, not in the long run. And they tend to view it as being just an emotion and not as something that, you know, they tend to be forgiving people who just want to go and make for the best world for everyone that they can. I would think God could do much better than them. He certainly has lots of advantages over even the best of the people that who are best positioned that we could know. But for some reason, he behaves like a spoiled little child. Yeah.
Now, I want to just rewind a bit here and say something about, you'd given a sort of example of where we would want, a person would want revenge if he was wronged in some horrible way. And if that's a norm, if we're going to go and celebrate that sort of spiteful, vindictive, revenge-seeking behavior. Well, people who know that we reward that are going to be deterred. And I think that's okay, but perhaps a better example would be to talk about an actual social institution and not to talk about individual people. Because I can imagine listeners out there, especially listeners who don't agree with you, at least not in advance, thinking to themselves, well, of course this example is going to go wrong because we're talking about individual people going and making their own revenge, making their own justice. And that's not what justice is. Justice is sort of an external institution kind of thing. But I wanted to point out that your example would still work for an institution. If we had laws and we just really wanted, as a society, to punish our criminals, and we just, the person who was wronged, for example, in your illustration, we could say, instead of being seeking his own personal revenge, he could deeply desire the criminal who had wronged him to pay the legal penalty, to be punished according to what the law requires, because, well, he just wants that criminal to pay his dues. And that's, again, that's all well and good if there is a long-term goal in sight, if there is the safety of the society, the protection of the people, the end result, the maximal happiness and minimal suffering of people.
That's why we should endorse, sometimes, we arguably should endorse the retributive impulse. But we should be clear that, you know, if you really have a retributive impulse, you don't care about the extent to which that's your motivation, you don't care about the well-being of anyone. You're just concerned about making that jerk pay.
Oh, yeah. Right? And that's a good point to go ahead and drive home, because, yeah, I don't want to give the impression that the person who, again, returning to this person who's wronged, he's not going to be thinking to himself, well, you know, if I don't go and express some kind of vengeance against this person, or if I don't go and support him paying his legal dues, as it were, well, people just aren't going to respect me, and people aren't going to respect the law. And so, no, that's not what he's concerned about. He really just has it out for this criminal who has wronged him, and he feels very very bad about that, very angry about that, perhaps. And you know, he knows, being a person who was raised in society, who's no stranger to the justice system, he knows that according to the justice system, that criminal deserves his due punishment. And so, well, of course he's going to support that. But it's not to obtain some instrumental end. The instrumental end comes in an external view of it, where we're asking ourselves, as reflective people, what kind of values do we want to celebrate? What kind of values do we want to support and endorse? Do we want to go ahead and say that's okay for the man to want the criminal to pay his legal dues? And the answer is, well, yeah. We want people to feel that way because the justice system is valuable to us in this human society. But for God, well, God doesn't have the limitations that we do. Presumably, God has unlimited resources. It doesn't make any sense for me to suppose that God has a justice system aimed at achieving some kind of instrumental end. Mm-hmm. I think the only way to talk about divine justice is to just say, as I mentioned before, that God has set up all these rules, and he just loves these rules, and he wants people to follow the rules, and he wants to follow them himself. And he is just bonkers over these rules that he's set up. And, hey, if it results in people being tortured forever, well, he just loves the rules too much. And yeah. that seems to me just the height of immorality.
Well, in a recent blog post, though, that we, you know, you pointed out that you participated in, Alexander Pruss takes a different view. It's kind of interesting.
Oh yeah,
he argues that you know, really, punishment is. For, he's not unique in this. I mean, actually, this is an idea that we find in Kant, for instance, as well. That in some sense, punishment is for the sake of the person who's being punished. Retributive punishment. We're not talking about reformation, but punishment in hell, even where there's no end to it, is for the sake of the person who's actually being punished.
It's strange. I mean, he thinks that the punishment actually has value to the person being punished, even though that person doesn't realize it.
Yeah.
It's okay. Let me go ahead and Pruss has this view where retributive punishment is good for the evildoer. That's what the actual title of the blog post is. And he says, this is a quote from him, "Of course it's possible to receive something of value without appreciating its value. The repentant sinner appreciates the value of justly deserved harsh treatment. That is, in fact, one of the signs of a criminal's repentance. But the unrepentant sinner does not appreciate it. Appreciate it. But it has value nonetheless," he says. "If it didn't, it wouldn't be a sign of vice that one does not appreciate it." So this is Pruss's view. And, mm-hmm. you know, in response, I just asked, you know, in what sense is it good? You know, what is this mysterious value that it has? And he, to his credit, he said, well, he wasn't sure, but here's some of my speculations, he said. And he says, well, here's one option. It's a species of being respected. So, you know, to punish someone is to show them respect somehow. The other one was, it's a species of efficacy. It's the last effect of one's actions. Now, I'm not sure how this is supposed to play out as something of value. But there it is. That's what he... And again, this is just speculation on his part. He's not actually advocating these views. He's just spitballing.
And
let me just read the third one real quick, because this is what I think is the most interesting. It's good to see things as they are, he says. And when you go and when you're punished for your crime, you are being made acutely aware of, you know, what you deserve, what has been done. This is something, it's knowledge, and of course knowledge is valuable, and so hence on this view, it's valuable to be punished because it just really drives home that awareness of your wicked guilt. So these are speculations, and I thought you had... I would expect you to want to respond most to that last one.
Yeah, I would respond. Well, first of all, I like your responses to it. You point out that God presumably could give the wicked whatever knowledge they were lacking just by virtue of his power to impart knowledge through, you know, he's omnipotent after all, right? So you don't need an object lesson there. You don't need to go and... you know, inflict the knowledge through suffering. And then you, maybe the more important point is, on balance, it isn't worth it. It's like you're, you know, it's as if you were giving me, you know, I like jelly beans, so you're giving me some jelly beans and making me eat them, but they also cause horrible nausea. And it's like, yeah, I like jelly beans. They're tasty, but it ain't worth it. You aren't serving me when you're giving me poison along with it. I would, even beyond that, though, I would say, you know, why does somebody, because another point that he makes is that, you know, well, people want to be punished sometimes. And I would ask, why do people want to be punished when they do want to be punished? isn't it so that they can avoid other, you know, negative things? Like, if I'm punished, then maybe people will stop reminding me of what I did. Maybe I'll get along better socially. Maybe I'll feel like I, you know, because I've been enculturated to think in terms of retribution, in terms of, you know, debt payment even, I will be prepared to, you know, because I've been punished, I'll be able to go on and not blame myself anymore, because that's what I, you know, believe about blame and punishment. Why not just make it so people don't feel guilty like that if you're God? Why not alter people's psychology so that they just really feel assured that it's okay now? You know, it's not as if, you know, I mean, the idea that there's something deep about the value of being punished, that it isn't just a contingent matter, just a matter of, you know, what it's like to be a human being, to have a psychology that isn't sociopathic, that's sensitive to what others think of them, and, you know, our capacity to go and evaluate ourselves from kind of an objective point of view and to recognize that we aren't as good of a person as maybe we'd like to be. I think those are the things that go into the desire of some people to be punished, and they're things that could be dispensed with, certainly by God. Does that make sense?
Sure. Yeah. No. I hadn't even really thought about your last point, but certainly your first point about, on balance, you know, even if some aspect of the hell experience had value to you, I mean, that just doesn't seem a good reason for God and to go, you know, say, okay, well, I'm gonna shuttle you off to hell so that you can find value in this one aspect of hell, and well, you won't find much value in the other aspects of hell, I don't understand what's so important about these individual aspects that Christians want to pick out. They want to pick out free choice. They want to say, no, we got to respect free choice at all costs. Mm-hmm. They want to pick out justice, the rules of God's game. They want to say that, yes, we have got to support the rules, even if it means torturing people for eternity. Mm-hmm. They want to pick out, Pruss is thinking about picking out maybe the knowledge of wickedness and saying, well, yeah, it's nice for people to have knowledge of their wickedness. So, hey, that's worth torturing people forever over. I mean, I don't know. Why can't Christians just go and say, well, you know, I guess eternal torture is a little bit of a higher priority than those things? That just doesn't seem like a big leap to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me add this. If you're a Christian, you know, all of those saved people, all those people who did things that were wicked, but had Jesus, you know, Jesus died for their sins, well, they aren't getting this wonderful benefit, right? I mean, they aren't getting to be punished for their sins.
Right.
And, you know, maybe they get the vicarious pleasure in Jesus having been suffered, you know, so that they kind of, you know, get to enjoy that. I mean, again, if you gave the, you know, why not just offer that to the person who is damned? Then they could have that benefit. Just let them know, hey, you could avoid this and you could still enjoy Jesus' suffering in the way that others do. And also, I mean, again, the knowledge, again, they, you know, the saved don't have to, they can somehow gain the knowledge of their suffering, of, you know, how bad their sins are without actually having to be tormented. So apparently it's not that big of a deal, even in Christian theology, to do that. The redemption itself is just the idea that you can go and, well, if I torture you, that'll somehow make it all right. You know, I can go and I can torture myself. I can make it all right. That's another kettle of fish right there. That's just ridiculous to think that has any, you know, purchase in any kind of human morality anyway, any you know, the way that we would be concerned about how to treat others. It confuses kind of criminal law with tort law, you know, where, you know, we just want to go and have a debt paid versus saying, no, we actually want to punish you, you know. It's,
right.
It's, you know, it confounds those two, and it doesn't, it really doesn't make much sense. Although that isn't, in defense of Christians, that's not the only understanding of the significance of the crucifixion. So,
sure, there are lots of different theologies about the crucifixion, and just about everything in Christian theology has different interpretations among different groups of Christians, and that's how it's always been.
Sure.
Well, I think we're out of time, though, aren't we?
Okay.
So, I guess it's we've covered a great deal, more than I expected, actually. So, that's great. I hope all of our listeners have enjoyed the podcast. I know we had some technical difficulties through most of it, and they weren't repaired until just these last few minutes, and I regret that. But hopefully it wasn't too much of an inconvenience for our listeners to suffer through the torment of our technical difficulties. So
it's a sample of the tortures to come if you don't believe in Jesus Christ.
There you go.
Hope you appreciated the knowledge that we may have imparted to you through sex. Right.
This is how bad things can be when you have technical difficulties. And if you don't know that by now, well, at least, well, hopefully you appreciate the value in that. So, okay, well, you all out there have a great day, and be good to each other.
Have a good one.